The numbers are in, and they are all over the place. From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio, who's on assignment. All right, so the economy is giving us some conflicting signs this week. On the one hand, 1.2 million people claimed jobless benefits last week. That is bad, but it is a lot better than economists were bracing for. So there's that kind of positive. On the other hand, we've got some disappointment. The economy added 167,000 jobs to private payrolls, according to ADP. That is a lot worse than economists were hoping for. They thought we'd get 1.2 million jobs. So what does it all mean? Diane Swonk is chief economist with tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
We've got these numbers. They're all over the place. What do they mean?
You know, what's important about it is that although the jobless claims are coming down, that was the week ended August 1st, so we don't know that some people might not have actually applied for jobless benefits because that is actually as we saw a lot of unemployment benefits expire for a lot of people and the expansion to employment benefits. Also, our threshold on what is good in improving has gone down dramatically. We still have more people applying for unemployment claims than we did in any week in the worst of any other recession in the post-World War II period. And the sheer volume of people, the number of people still on continuing claims, over 16 million, is more than double that we saw during the Great Recession. So, you know, these numbers, although moving for 1 week's time in the right direction, do not really give us a lot of confidence. What they suggest is that the pace of hiring has slowed, the pace of rehiring has slowed quite dramatically, and that's worrisome because many more people are going to be permanently unemployed instead of what they thought was a temporary situation back in March.
So tomorrow we're getting the official government jobs numbers for July. Is that basically going to be a test of the direction the economy is moving?
Well, it will tell us one thing, and that is, you know, how much the pace of employment has slowed and maybe even contract in the month of August. We're worried about where we're going right now. And the most important issue is no matter what the number is, it looks like it's going to be significantly smaller than it was in the last 2 months and a small fraction of what we need to rehire people that lost their jobs due to COVID, let alone create new jobs for those people entering the labor force today.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at the tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Friday is the self-imposed deadline for the White House and Democrats in Congress to reach a deal on another round of pandemic relief. The two sides are still at odds over many things. That $600 a week in supplemental unemployment payments for starters. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on where things stand.
Republicans initially wanted to reduce the $600 a week benefit to $200 a week until the end of the year, saying providing any more money to the unemployed could disincentivize returning to work. Now the White House is offering to renew the benefit at $400 a week, but congressional Democrats remain firm on their demand for a full renewal. There are other thorny issues. The White House is offering at least $150 billion to shore up state and local government budgets. Democrats are demanding almost $1 trillion. Democrats also want to boost SNAP benefits, known as food stamps, by 15% and to provide help for rental and mortgage payments. And they remain opposed to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's call for lawsuit protections for businesses, schools, and charities that operate during the pandemic. Areas of agreement between the two sides include another $1,200 in direct payments to most Americans, more funding to childcare and community health centers, as well as $100 billion or more for schools. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
The White House, meanwhile, has threatened to take unilateral action, like imposing an eviction moratorium and a payroll tax cut if a broader deal can't be reached.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
The NCAA just announced Wednesday it is canceling Division II and III championships. Regular games are still on for now, though that could change soon. Some schools have opted to postpone games because of the pandemic. The economic effect of canceling or postponing college football events is felt not only on campus, but in the surrounding communities. From KCUR in Kansas City, Greg Eklund reports on two small towns where football means business.
Coke Diet Coke, Sprite, lemonade, root beer.
Joe's Diner in Baldwin City, Kansas, got a lift this summer in the midst of the pandemic when it reopened. In the fall, it serves a lot of patrons who come for football played at Baker University. Baker is in a one-stoplight town of less than 5,000. April Strawn, the manager of Joe's Diner, says she's glad Baker is moving ahead with a delayed fall season. But if there's a spike in positive tests, forcing a cancellation?
It'll be awful. It would be absolutely awful.
Especially since the Baker Wildcats have been on a roll with five straight appearances in the NAIA, or small college, playoffs. With social distancing in a small stadium, Baker Athletics Director Nate Hauser says some people will be left out.
The potential of, you know, not having our family at games is going to be something that's going to be very, very different.
If Baker reaches the playoffs again, the NAIA announced that postseason football won't start until next spring.
Go Cats!
Those are Bearcat fans at Northwest Missouri State in Maryville, a town of around 12,000, less than 3 hours from Baldwin City. Enrollment at Northwest Missouri State makes up about half the town's population.
Anytime you can take 5,000-6,000 kids who are come into town and with the spending age, and they'll go to the restaurants, the bars, the grocery stores, the T-shirt shops.
That's T-shirt shop owner Jim Gerken.
That's a huge influx of cash and also operating capital, tax money, income, and when they go, it's you see it.
Now, Northwest Missouri isn't scheduled to play its first game until early October. It's something. But because games are starting late with limited crowds this fall, small college football towns around the country will still feel the pinch. In Kansas City, I'm Greg Eklund for Marketplace.
So, you think this year has been a Kafkaesque hellscape for you? Try being a supply chain in 2020. Cyber attacks, trade disputes, coronavirus, natural disasters. It is really hard to manage a complex web of business relationships around the globe when strands keep falling out. Research out later today from the McKinsey Global Institute describes the costs of all of this. Susan Lund is a partner with McKinsey and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we attach a dollar value to all of these disruptions to supply chains around the world?
We can. So in our new research, we've been able to look at the rising frequency of supply chain disruptions and then what it costs companies. So on average, companies can expect to lose half of a year's profits over the course of a decade. You know, you might say, well, that doesn't sound like so much, but companies worry over every percentage point drop in EBITDA and the market pummels them. So that's a huge loss. And in an event like COVID, of course, the damage is much more extreme.
How do you make a supply chain more resilient to a shock like COVID?
Well, having a more diverse set of suppliers is one way, and that's where the shifting to different countries comes in. But there are lots of other ways and things that companies can do. Probably the most important thing is to digitize their supply chain and get transparency, not only on who their direct suppliers are, but going through all the tiers of the supply chain. Then companies can also do things like hold more inventory. They can design products to have less complex and unique parts that simplify the supply chain. There's a whole set of actions that companies can undertake, and each one will have to decide which ones make sense for their business.
Susan Lund, partner at the McKinsey Global Institute, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.